Before going into the subject matter, I'd like to define some terms for the reasons of clarity in the field of diary novels. When I'm speaking of author, I mean the author of the novel, and when I speak of writer, on the other hand, this refers to the fictional person who is writing the fictional diary within the novel. So, for instance, in Ding Ling's Diary of Sophia, Ding Ling is the author, and Sophia is the writer. Then we also need to distinguish at least three levels at which we will look. The intratextual level, or the story world level, that is life as it is experienced, interpreted, described by the writer in the diary, and sometimes also as it is perceived by an intratextual reader. For instance, a fictional editor or friend of the writer. Then second, we have the perceptual level, that is the diary novel and the diary within it, as it is perceived and interpreted by the extratextual reader, that is us reading the novel. And third, an authorial or creational level, that is the diary novel and the diary within it, as it is arranged and constructed or composed by the author. Now, for those of you who are not in Chinese studies, a short introduction. The time I'm dealing with is the turbulent decades after the fall of the last dynasty, the Qing dynasty in 1911, after which the Republic of China was declared. It is a time that continues with reforms which were started in the last decades of the Qing dynasty in order to regain state strength and to counter the dominance of Western colonial or semi-colonial powers in China. These reforms, most of which tried to adopt Western role models, became more radically than before, I think this we can say. The intellectual import from Western ideas increased dramatically, not least in the years of the so-called May 4th movement, but also before, so this movement linked to the year 1990. It was brought forward by a new generation of young intellectuals, most of whom were trained in Japan or directly in the West. It is also a time of unprecedented renewal, covering all aspects of life, politics, values, techniques, in this sense, a renewal of culture at large. And literature played an important part in conveying the new ideals. The genre of diary novels hails the new conception of the modern human being, an exodus from the old society into individualism, subjectivity, progress, and an open future of an individual and sovereign selfhood. Thereby, the individual gained the chance, but also the obligation, to create or construct meaning of their own life. Optionality and the open future do raise uncertainty, an uncertainty with which the individual needs to cope somehow. For all this, the diary novel seems to be the optimal form. It focuses on the single individual who is at the center of his or her world and who tries to make sense and develop a meaningful worldview. It borrows notions of authenticity, immediacy, intimacy, and truthfulness, but also notions of contingency and an open future from the real diary, especially from the European type of the journal intime that was vividly perceived by May 4th authors. And we have luminaries like George Sorin or Idafu who wrote programmatically on diary writing, although not on diary novels. They saw the diary as a means to embark on the search for a modern subjectivity, and they did not really try to link it to the rich Chinese tradition of autobiographic writing, although especially George Sorin had good training in classical literature. One aspect that fits into this shift towards the Western model, that is not really surprising as a move in the time of the May 4th movement, is the age of writers. Traditional autobiographic writing and also diaristic forms like Buddhist Chanshu, for example, that aim at a daily self-evaluation or other daily analytic records of events and thoughts were written broadly in traditional China, albeit at all age, if not even more by older writers. The new journal intime type of diary in contrast is rather written by the young aspiring intellectual. This social function has found its way into the fictional form of diary novels as well, a genre that was a fully fictional text was new in China and quickly became fashionable. And I've listed for you the more prominent texts there behind me. And I'm going to deal today with, I hope if the time allows it, with three texts. The first one, Lu Xun's Diary of a Madman, then Lu In, Diary of Li Shi, and here the third one from Shi Pingmei, The Prayer Diary of Wang Wan. The usual writer of such fictional diaries is young, often between 20 to 30 years of age. And in many cases, but not always, this fits the actual age of authors. Now a few words to the problematics of diary novels as a form. And now I want to ask you something. Who of you has ever written a diary? Oh, come on, don't be shy. Okay. Now who of you thinks that this text, as it is, makes a good novel? Okay, that is expectable. Happy that it worked. The own real diary might be an interesting text for many reasons, but it lacks decisive structural elements of a novel. The own self is exceptional, but not really representative. It is more than unclear whether the own experiences depicted in such a diary are of interest to any other reader. There is no plot line that is structured into a beginning and an end, not to speak of climaxes or any other structure of composure. Problems that take large sections of a diary for some time might simply fade away because persons connected to these problems are moving elsewhere. And very obviously, that is no real option for a novel, not even for a postmodern one. The genre of diary novel is difficult to explain. There is no really exact or embracing definition, despite the most banal one, that the diary novel is a novel that makes use of the form of diaries. Then what is a diary novel? It is often, but not always, structured by smaller paragraphs that resemble a diary entry, and usually, but also not always, headed by a date. The entries thus comprise of experiences, memories, feelings, and thoughts of one day, but again, this is not always the case. And when we take a look at the issues that are discussed in order to define the diary novel, we find the discussion centers about four issues. First, the mimetic functions that regards the relation between the model of a real diary and a diary novel, and also issues of fictionality. We find discussions on thematic functions, that is the scope of view. That means the self, plus what? Friends, family, society at large, and also the self at all. And linked to this are also utilitarian aesthetic functions, like whom does it aim at? Then we have temporal functions, concerned mostly with the time of writing. That means both as distance to experience, so I experience something and then when do I write it down, and also as duration of composing. Also the distance between the writer when writing and himself as his own subject. And also all the questions that deal with the arrangement of time and narration within the diary. And then we have further generic functions like the perspective of the first person narrator, a range of structural aspects that I will touch upon later, the relation of the diary novel to epistolary novels and to novel writing as such. In all these fields, I guess you will instantly have something in mind that would describe the genre diary novel. However, all this is discussed very controversially, and there is no coherent definition. None of the characteristics that seem so obvious, not even the single entry structure headed by a date, is really mandatory. Nonetheless, you usually will find more than only one of such characteristics in novels that are labeled diary novels. The protagonists or writers of the diaries do not merely attempt to explain their present life and their experiences. They regularly transcend the boundaries of immediacy. They also deal with their distant past and their hopes and fears, and thus with their future, mostly with their near future. They read the signs and try to interpret them. Here we see a typical doubling of hermeneutic levels that is designated from novels. The intertextual process within the story world, by which characters try to understand their own world, and the process of encoding and decoding by authors and readers in the real world. The writers in the story world interpret signs as referring to their own future. The writers in the story world interpret, the signs have the character of urgency. Also on the intertextual level, reading and interpreting these signs is a practice of prognostication for the writers about their own life. On the perceptual level, that is for us as readers, it is a basic hermeneutic practice to make sense of the story, to predict the possible development of the plot and the characters within the as-if game of fictionality, while the writers in the novels read them in a mode of as-so, and not of as-if. However, the writers and we, the readers, are reading the same signs or textual signals in the text, and we use the same methods to interpret them. Yet we have different hermeneutic attitudes. For the writers, these are signs in the full sense, that is, tokens which refer to their world and unveil hidden meaning. For us, these are rather indicators. And I will come now to my first example, that is the diary of a madman, Chronology by Lu Xun. Lu Xun's text is maybe the iconic exodus into modern literature. Lu Xun, as an author and as an intellectual, is labeled the father of modern literature. And his Diary of a Madman is the point of departure and simultaneously the masterpiece of modern short novel. Lu Xun's text is entitled Diary and perceived as a fictional diary by readers and critics. However, we do not find any dates in the entries. We do have separated entries that appear as being related to different time slots. We can also see that each entry is in itself more or less coherent and distinguishable from entries before and after. However, the entries are headed simply by numbers, 12 in total. The novel starts with a fictional introduction by a fictional editor. The established interpretation reads the novel as an allegory, analyzing the fundamental principle of Chinese society based on its history. And Lu Xun here makes use of the metaphor of cannibalism, so declaring Chinese society a cannibalistic society. He borrows from Nikolai Gogol the literary technique of an inversion of the normal and the mad through the diagnosis of the writer as a madman who discovers this feature of his own tradition. The diary proper starts with a very short entry of 5 sentences, and you see behind me the first entry, that have at least 2 predictive functions. The writer, at this moment still in a somewhat pre-predictive notion, raises doubts as to his future, strong enough to recognize the looks of the Zhao family dog as a sign, and to interpret it according to his doubts. For the reader, this first entry serves as a predictive indicator, setting the scope for the development of what at this moment might be mental illness or a truth about the world, depending on how the reader evaluates the editorial note. The text operates with 2 oppositions, the brightness, Guang, of the moon, thus starting the repeated use of the moon metaphor, and the faintness of the writer's condition, Fa Hun. Lu Xun thus sets, or lets the writer set, the opposition not on the level of light directly, between bright and dark, this would have been an, but between bright and faint, and thus at first sight between the light of the moon and the condition of the mind, which takes up also the Buddhist tradition of the moon metaphor as something that hints to the illusionary character of the world, although it's usually rather the image of the moon in the water, which we don't find here. The second opposition unfolds between the lack of knowledge caused by the condition of faintness over the last 30 years and the sudden certainty of fear, stating, I have good reasons for my fears, and thus closing the first entry. For the reader, this first entry furthermore establishes a tension between what can be perceived, what is concealed, what can be unveiled through recognizing and interpreting it as a sign and what is fate. Quite contrary to the program of modernity, the scope set here is not hailing self-responsibility or mastery of one's life, but dependency of reading opaque signs like a dog's look to unveil the own future and society's past. Open to the reader at this point is, however, whether this notion of non-modern fate is a result of the writer's madness or some kind of human destiny overshadowing the course of Chinese modernity. The entries 2-7 further develop the writer's existential fear by unveiling further signs and reconfirming older ones. Thereby we see an increasing competence of the mad writer to see and decode these signs, and thus again the tension between what is hidden and what is acknowledgeable. Strikingly, it is the madman, who in Lu Xun's text is usually interpreted as the representative of modernity, who unveils immoral traditions through interpreting signs. The conception of the world behind these signs is that of a world structured or ordered by a hidden or higher power and characterized by compound meaning. This element of world order significantly links cosmological or heavenly order, all embracing conspiracies and fictional story worlds on a structural level. More interesting is entry 8, and I just have some quotes here, is entry number 8 that takes on a rather traditional form of presenting illusionary dreams in Chinese novel writing. Like in dreams that we find, for instance, in the Shui Hu Chuan, the reader is not instantly aware that the protagonist slips into an illusionary world. The writer here, in our case, suddenly recognizes a man coming towards him. He interrogates him, but the unknown man evades his questions, and the dialogue turns into a condensed repetition of his fears regarding cannibalism and the appeasement by his family and staff. The first sign for the reader that this meeting is illusionary is set when the writer states that he, I quote, wasn't able to make out what he looked like too clearly. And finally, the writer jumps up, looks around, only to find that, I quote again, the fellow was nowhere to be seen. I was soaked in sweat. And I think both the absence and the sweat are clear signs that everything before was a dream or an illusion that reconfirms the writer's doubts or fears. The writer's experiences a second illusion or dreamlike situation at the end of entry 10. He retreats into his dark room, where the room's beams and rafters grow bigger and bigger, trying to crush him to death by their increasing weight. Of course, for the reader, this metaphor is easily decipherable as the oppressing weight of tradition. More interesting here is that the writer recognizes the oppressing weight as an illusion, struggles his way out, and exclaims, "Change this minute, change from the bottom of your hearts. You ought to know that in future, they are not going to allow cannibals in the world anymore." While this is the programmatic claim of modernity and enlightenment, it is initiated through a dreamlike illusion displaying a clearly prognosticating message, combined with the issue of intervention once the future is clearly prognosticated. In the light of this knowledge, the future can be changed. The end of entry 11 and the remaining text have mainly one authorial function, that is to ensure the reader in reading this text as a mirror in which the seemingly normal and abnormal are in reverse order. Now, the conception of dreams have largely changed in modern times, except for the most fundamental issue. Dreams have meaning. They are telling something in a decoded way which needs to be unveiled through interpretation. The method to interpret dreams was and is hermeneutics. They differ, however, conceptually in their origins and functions. In pre-modern, or I should rather say maybe in pre-psychological times, and particularly also in the context of divination, dreams are often, not always, but often sought to be given, fully or partly produced from out of the dreamer's mind. As such, they are messages sent to the dreamer for specific reasons. Traditionally, dreams may refer to a broad spectrum from highest state affairs down to individual behavior, However, quite generally, they refer to the future and thus have a prognosticating function to cope with the world or the self in the world. Now, once the dreams got into the claws of psychologists, this changed drastically. The dreams are still telling, but now they are produced by the own unconsciousness. They refer to the self, predominantly to the own past, and even more predominantly to a traumatic past. And they have a therapeutic function to cope with the self. Now, in diary novels, and not only in the type that we see in the Chinese Republic, in diary novels, they are both. Despite being concerned with the modern individual, a strong notion of fate remains. It is not merely the individual's psyche that speaks in dreams. It is also the situation of the world. Dreams are personal and collective. They explain the past and present and unveil the future. More precisely, the target of the dream message in Lu Xun's novel is the collective, the Chinese society that is stuck in empty, oppressing traditions that blocks the departure into a successful modernity. Of course, this kind of collectivization and the psychologically based dream is a general literary device that is not specifically to be found in diary novels. Protagonists are always negotiated along the boundary between uniqueness and representation. They need to be unique enough, that is, endowed with particular and individual pattern, but also typical and representative enough so that the reader can identify without rendering the character too banal. And I'm going on to the next one, and we can see some further problems of the form here. Lu Yin is hailed as one of the most talented female authors, an icon of the modern woman. After the death of her first husband, she tried and also half managed to live by her writings, thus being one of the very rare professional female authors of her time. In 1923, she published The Diary of Li Shi. The text, like most of the fictional diaries of the time, differs from Lu Xun in more accurately simulating the diary form. The Diary of Li Shi starts on a December 21st and ends on a February 5th. In between, we find 16 entries, the year is missing. Like Lu Xun's text, the fictional text here begins with a fictional paratext, that is a simulated editor's introduction. In this case, we have a close friend of Li Shi who seems to remember the day of Li Shi's death a year ago and decides to publish Li Shi's diary because she wants to prove that Li Shi died of mental illness and not through a bodily indication. And thus again, we find the topos of mental illness that somehow illuminates the condition of the Chinese society. In this case, however, it's not the condition at large, but the individual case of love. However, revolting enough for the 19th early 20s, not only in China, the theme is lesbian love between the writer Li Shi and another young woman by the name of Yuan Qing. And there are real-life similarities, since the author Lu Yin was said to have lesbian tendencies, not least for Shi Pingmei, my third author, whom I will touch upon later, it means maybe. Given the fictional editor's note, the reader starts this diary novel by knowing the writer will have died afterwards. The path towards death is therefore given for the reader, but in feigning the structure of a real diary, the writer Li Shi cannot know this when writing. Given the fictional editorial hint of a mental illness as the reason of the writer's death, we might expect some features as depression or else. However, what we are presented with unfolds a world that teleologically runs towards the bitter, predestined end. Even more, it appears that this end is not merely predestined as a second-level knowledge shared by the fictional editor and the reader, but also as a first-level manifestation for the writer Li Shi herself. The first of such signs occurs right in the first entry. The writer Li Shi refers to Qu Yuan and to King Huai of Chu, and thus puts the theme of death on the agenda, either as suicide or after being repeatedly captured. A second hint comes right in the next entry when Li Shi records a poem by Tang poet Wang Wei. on the ninth day of the ninth month, thinking of my brothers east of the mountains. Neither Wang Wei nor the title of the poem is mentioned by name in the diary. That fits to the mode of diary writing. The writer does not need to make this kind of references, but it also signals obviously that Lu Yin, as the author, thought that this is enough. The reader will recognize what is behind this. And Li Shi only records the first two lines. Alone in a foreign place as a foreign man, when this festival comes, the thoughts for family duplicate. And I have given you the original and two translations, which you can see there behind me. Wang Wei wrote this poem at the age of 16, when he stayed in the capital and prepared for the exams. On the one hand, this poem signals the present condition of the writer, Li Shi, who stays at school board as well. However, despite the change in gender, Li Shi records this poem on a December 22nd, and it soon becomes clear that the person longed for is not family or brothers, but rather her sister in mind and love, Yuan Qing. And there's also a temporal gap. Wang Wei, of course, refers to the lunar calendar. And I think we can do whatever we want. The ninth day of month nine, it will never become December 22nd. I think there's no way to this. For the reader, this poem thus turns into a signal that increases the mental pressure, if maybe rather ex post than really right away. On December 26th, the writer recalls a line from Alexander Pushkin's novel from 1836, The Captain's Daughter. A short quote only, if you take a wife, everything is over. And like in the case of Wang Wei, literature annotates life, but also reaches out into the future, when the love of the writer Li Shi, this woman Yuan Qing, will be married to a young promising man then by early February. On the perceptual level, we can easily decipher the annotation as a textual signal. Within the story world, however, they contribute to a notion of life in which the writer's contact with specific literary texts does not come by chance, but is an expression of a fated life. Now, like Lu Xun, Lu Yin also makes intensive use of the moon metaphor and of dreams, partly happy ones about a shared future with Yuan Qing, partly nightmares. I'm skipping these here. Instead, the increasing density of the death scene needs to be emphasized. On December 29th, Li Shi, while ill, receives a letter by a friend called Yunwen, stating that when she, this Yunwen, had been ill 3 years ago, it sometimes went bad and sometimes it went good, but she, I quote, didn't fear death. Death is the end of everything. Li Shi thinks that Yunwen's opinion is not wrong. She writes, the end is nothing else but death. Surely with death everything comes to its end. And she concludes that all one can do is looking out for death. And she writes then, when you're dead, there will be no need anymore for jealousy or conflict. After her love, Yuan Qing parted from her, she falls ill again and writes in her last entry on February 5th, Alas, the more I recall, and this refers to Yuan Qing's betrayal, the more I recall, the more I feel hurt. Day by day, I write down how Yuan Qing discarded me, and then I just hate that I can't leave this world immediately forever. But I don't dare to kill myself. To die from depression, to die from depression. Before I desired to live, estimated life's value, but it's not worth it. Oh Lord, I just want you to take me a bit earlier. We can clearly see how the entry from December 29th predates the last one and serves as a clear textual sign anticipating the later development. Li Shi also explicitly ponders about the topic of future and the meaninglessness of life, which I think I'm going to skip. What is noteworthy in this case is not that there are signs in life that can be interpreted as related to the future. The remarkable issue is rather that the life of the writer is filled with science. There's hardly anything that is not related to the end of the diary or brings forward the narrative closure of the text. In the case of Lewin's text, one might see this as an editorial effect of the fictional editor, the writer's friend, who presents a selection that has been sharpened to the point of interest. That is to prove that Leach's death is caused by mental illness. However, the effect is that we as readers get a vision of life that is teleologically organized and runs towards a predestined end. And the next example should have shown some more characteristics, but I think I'm skipping May also, and directly go on to more theoretical issues. Some theoretical issues that will concern the link between the issue of fictionality, hermeneutical consequences, and the question of prediction. The diary novel borrows a range of elements from real diaries, like radical subjectivity, intimacy as a source and a gateway to authenticity and trustworthiness, which again installs the notion of reliability and even truth as far as the themes of individual crisis and social critique are concerned. This is the level of values and subject matter. However, concomitantly, diary novels are also adopting the form by which these effects shall be achieved. What is adopted on the level of the diary form is the limitation of single-day entries. Real diaries are fragmentary, unplanned. They develop as the real life of the authors develop, subject to a high degree of contingency, with unclosed event lines and changing topics that are dealt with in a preliminary mode. As such, as we saw before, not the perfect candidate for making a novel that shall advocate a specific national, collective, and individual agenda. German author Arno Schmidt has called this genre a convenient half-chaos, ein gemütliches Halbchaos. And he went on, and I will read out my translation, my humble translation from that German text. A diary is necessarily unordered. Kismet doesn't care at all whether someone consumes his love before or after exams, on August 1st or February 17th. The author who chooses a diary as a possible framework for his book surrenders to the problem of form. The diary is a muddlehead's alibi. It is one of the latrines of literature. And he further goes on, next thus, the artificially produced diary. If that is a serious literary form, my answer, you might guess, certainly not. Even the relatively best examples are shabby. Now this is a very pronounced judgment, which however didn't prevent Arno Schmidt from writing several diary novels himself. More important is that Arno Schmidt is in line with newer approaches emphasizing the fictionality of diary novels. The author might borrow elements like the fragmentary, the contingent, the unplanned, or immediate mode of writing, but the author simulates them. The diary novel is quite different from Arno Schmidt's verdict, not fragmentary. It is not contingent, it is certainly planned and arranged. Especially the limitation in time is resolved by a range of literary devices, as we have seen, devices that not least serve to establish a coherent story world. In a diary novel, we usually find closures to the important plot lines. If not, they are left open intentionally, and they are developed up to a point from which the reader can consider the issue by himself. There are no aspects that are really unimportant to the story. Of course, the production of a coherent text is the usual aspect of novel writing. That is what we expect from an author. However, in this case, it is problematic. While arrangement, coherence, forms of suspense, and intertextual signs, signals, and references are normal devices of narration and storytelling, the diary as a form suggests the opposite. The narrative structure establishes not merely an overall theme, but also a teleological structure that applies on several levels, as Clarence Wolwood suggests. First, on the level of the author during the writing process, and that is what Clarence Wollard calls the authorial stance, what we traditionally called in back in our school times, what the author wants to say. Second, to the reader during the reading process as a hermeneutical process. The reader can rely on the assumption that there is a telos of some kind provided by the author or the text, which we as readers can accept or reject, we can alter it or replace it. And also, on the third level, the teleological structure applies to the writer of the fictional diary. To the writer, the telos will be formally unknown until the telos is achieved or reached, that is the end of story or the closure of narrative. The writer experiences a world that seems open and free, but is, in fact, predestined. This predestination determines how the writer interprets or relates science to their own future. The assumption of a narrative telos turns the story and the story world as a whole into a reservoir of signs that are interpretable in relation to this telos. Signs that reveal causes which lead or mandatorily will lead to the assumed telos. Gadamer says concerning the ontological function of the concept of teleology, in a practical context, it is not by chance that the intermediate agencies through which something is achieved prove suited to achieve the end. Rather, they are chosen from the outset as suitable means. In this sense, we can say that a teleological structure of narration turns the narrated story world into a principally predictable one. This effect can be seen on two levels, the intertextual one and the perceptual one. On the intertextual level, that is the story world in which the writer composes his diary, the effects caused by the diary form are drastic. Lorna Martens, in her volume The Diary Novel, writes, I quote, the diaristic in medias res implies a state of turmoil or excitement, an inability to predict the future, an urge to master and purge overwhelming experiences and intense emotions. So she talks about an inability to predict the future. However, Martin's notion of an unpredictable future is but a narrative effect of the linear form of the diary. It is a simulated inability. Suspense evolves from seeing the writer struggling with a fate unknown to them while writing. Looking at the subject matter of the fictional entries, the writers have hopes and fears, and they are making their claims for the future. From the reader's perspective, these claims obtain a narrative function and are not just randomly. They turn into predictions and even prophecies, and the writers become fortune tellers, diviners, or prophets on their own and society's behalf. This is an inward turn of the divinatory process, a unity of diviner and client. They are one and the same. In the special case of Republic in China, all this is set into a framework in which, as we have seen, the diary and the diary novel were hailed as the new forms to embark on the search on the new individual longing for modernization. To achieve this, tradition was severely criticized. The radical intellectuals of the time, as well as the writers in the diary novels, tried to escape traditional forms of fate. More precisely, they declined fate as a category. Life, so they thought, can be determined by the active and acting self. But in order to do so, the protagonists in the stories are hectically looking for signs and indications of the future in the present in order to be able to act in the future. Unfortunately, the modern mode of acting demands resources in terms of knowledge, or categories that help to rationally decide for actions and reactions, all of which was not at the protagonist's disposal. Fictionalizing the diary form thus results in transforming the quotidian and contingent into a teleological narrative structure. Thereby, the story world is charged with an increased density of meaning. Paradoxically, the fictional form of diary provokes a re-enchantment of the world. The writers are set into a world, for us the story world, that is full of signs that need to and can be interpreted. They experience and understand their world as being full of references and meaning, soaked, if you like Turkish baklava with syrup. It just needs to be read and interpreted accordingly. If one is unable to do so, it is to keep the metaphor a lack of taste, and thus the fault of the individual, not of the world. And this indeed is a paradox. While on the level of subject matter, these novels are praising modernity, optionality, and the open future for the new human being, the choice of form re-establishes quite the contrary, a teleological order in which the path of the writer not merely seems determined from the beginning on, but it also can be acknowledged and predicted through interpreting the own signs. However, there are important changes to a pre-modern world. Now, and that is in the environment of the May 4th movement, principally everyone is a diviner of their own fate. There is no need for complicated education or initiation. This seems to be a second enlargement of divinatory competences after Juicy. However, practically, it is not just anybody who is qualified to read the signs. It is, paradoxically, the high priest of modernity, the juvenile writer on the quest for the modern self, who is the adequate designer on his own behalf. The center around which meaning is produced is no longer a traditional system of order or structure, nor is it a modern system of science and or Western logic. The center is the individual, the writer in his or her mental and emotional existence. And although there is quite an investment of psychology into this framework, it does not represent an academically accurate image of Western psychology as it was prevalent in China during the first decades of the 20th century, or no, an earlier one. Instead, the individual serves as the transition point through which all meaning is transmitted and, more important, even generated. And for these writers, meaning is everywhere. Signs originate from dreams, from emotions and self-perception, from what others say or not, from what others do or not, from readings and scripts, or from the weather, the moon, the seasons, and so on and so forth. The question that Philip Balzinger posed several times in the last term, that is, how do I know what is a sign and what is not? That was a sign, maybe. This question is irrelevant. In the case of fictional diaries, it's easy. Everything is a sign. There is an overload of meaning to which the protagonists are helplessly exposed. They are no professionals, they are lay diviners, and their own clients with not much of a systematic approach to perform exegesis nor to interpret the signs. I will also skip this, but just as a notice, there's at least one other important similarity to divinatory practices, that is the importance of the topic of madness that we find very often in these novels. To come to the last point, the perceptual level, we as readers do read and interpret the signs or textual signals and make assumptions what exactly the tellers might be and which path the plot and the characters may take and which meaning the whole story may have. That is the usual hermeneutic process in reading fiction of any kind. As much as hermeneutics refer to the ongoing process of understanding the text while reading it in the present, and as much as it takes past reading experiences and extra-textual knowledges into account, so much it aims at the future, in which the meaning in a more comprehensive way than right now will become manifest. This is probably one of the issues that might link literature and divination. Both provide signs, more or less hidden, that need to be revealed, interpreted in order to make sense and to predict, or at least try to predict, what the closure of the single narration or of the single fate might be. In this sense, interpreting signs is a method or a possibility to manipulate the effects of chance and coincidence by integrating them into narration and coherence. And narration and coherence, both as an act of creation on behalf of the author and as an act of perception by the readers, are establishing structure. And even though this might not always be the same structure, they are manipulating the world into a non-chaotic structured one. Now, what do I mean by structure? Only in a structured, at least largely, although not completely, coherent world, science can have meaning. Science do need objects of reference, which are at least more or less reliable. The play of science needs a space between total chaos and total order. In this sense, structure does not necessarily mean structured by a will, or by any kind of order, cosmic law or principle. Nor do I mean a physical structure or a logical one, although the effect cause and result is important. At this point, I mean structure as a system of references that is coherent enough to provide a ground for hermeneutic methods to observe, detect, acknowledge, and interpret science in a meaningful way. And I want to emphasize that I'm not targeting at a postmodern understanding of signifiers, in which, if we follow Derrida, there is no out of context. The postmodern denial of any access and sometimes even existence of a real world has, I think, convincingly been challenged, and I don't think that it would be a fruitful approach to either divination or fiction. Other approaches, for instance, a more creational and performative one, like we find it in John the Evangelist, in the beginning was the word, nor an epistemological one like Gadamer's being that can be understood as language, do denote that there is nothing outside of language or texts. The way how science as language and real phenomena do relate, however, is heatedly debated, not only in semiotics and philosophy, but also in fiction theory, especially in regard to the concept of mimesis. This is where I am at the moment, and the complete shiny side of it still has to be done, as a problem that somehow popped up while I was working on my diaries. The importance of hermeneutics as a link between literature and divination is also something I like to discuss tomorrow. Is it beneficial at all to make up this link? If yes, in which way? And at last for today, some further considerations that touch upon the link between literature and divination that can be found in almost all cultures. Usually this is a link between poetry and divination. We find it in Cicero's De Divinatione, and for China, Michael Strickmann has written a complete book about Chinese poetry and prophecy. And if I understand Strickmann correctly, the link is more problematic in the Chinese case. Rhymed, he says on page 87, rhythmic or assonantial verse has at all times been a vehicle for the gods. In the Chinese case, poetry seems to be divine by form rather than by content. This might be different in other cases, I don't know. What usually is addressed by this link between poetry and divination is either a similarity between the author and the gods, spirits, or orders. This option suggests that the order is a divine or divine-like being or a vessel, or that the author operates in the modus of a diviner. Or a similarity between poetry and the divinatory text is addressed, which by default is an obscure text, somehow hidden and in need of interpretation. The latter would support the assumption of the importance of hermeneutic practices as a gateway to decipher hidden or embedded meanings through exegesis and interpretation now as a methodological link between literature and divination. Or if we take Gadamer even as an ontological link on the level of language as such. However, the similarities in hermeneutic practices of reading science and interpreting them, both in divination and in reading literature, would shift the link yet to another level, that is the level of perception, which links the practitioners who make sense of the science, the diviner who explains, the client who tries to make sense for himself of what he hears, the reader who tries to understand the novel, or even the writer within the fictional diary tries to make sense of his own life. And with that, I end. Thank you.